These discoveries led her back to autism yet again, a field to which she could now apply her scientific training and thinking. It would appear that some form of destiny kept directing her to the particular fields that she could explore and understand with single-minded purpose and master in her own ingenious way. For someone like Temple Grandin, the possibility of achieving mastery in any field would normally seem like an impossible dream. The obstacles in the path of someone with autism are enormous. And yet she managed to find her way to the two subjects that opened up possibilities for advancement. Although it might seem as if luck or blind fate led her there, even as a child, she intuited her natural strengths. Her love and feel for animals, her visual powers of thinking, her ability to focus on one thing, and leaned on them with all of her energy. Moving with these strengths gave her both the desire and resiliency to put up with all of the doubters, all those who saw her as strange and different, and who found the subject matter she chose to study too unconventional. Working in a field where she could use her natural empathy and her particular way of thinking to great effect, she was able to delve deeper and deeper into her chosen subject, arriving at a powerful inside sense of the world of animals. Once she had mastery in this realm, she was able to apply her skills to her other great interest, autism. Understand, achieving mastery in life often depends on those first steps that we take. It's not simply a question of knowing deeply our life's task, but also of having a feel for our own ways of thinking and for perspectives that are unique to us. A deep level of empathy for animals or for certain types of people may not seem like a skill or an intellectual strength, but in truth it is. Empathy plays an enormous role in learning and knowledge. Even scientists, renowned for their objectivity, regularly engage in thinking in which they momentarily identify with their subject. Other qualities we might possess, such as a penchant for visual forms of thinking, represent other possible strengths, not weaknesses. The problem is that we humans are deep conformists. Those qualities that separate us are often ridiculed by others or criticized by teachers. People with a high visual sense are often labeled as dyslexic, for example. Because of these judgments, we might see our strengths as disabilities and try to work around them in order to fit in. But anything that is peculiar to our makeup is precisely what we must pay the deepest attention to and lean on in our rise to mastery. Mastery is like swimming. It is too difficult to move forward when we are creating our own resistance or swimming against the current. Know your strengths and move with them. 3. Transform yourself through practice. The fingertip feel. As narrated in Chapter 2, after graduating from the Citadel in 1981, Cesar Rodriguez decided to enter the pilot training program for the United States Air Force. But soon he had to confront a harsh reality. He was not naturally gifted for flying a jet plane. Among those in the program were some who were known as Golden Boys. They seemed to have a knack for flying at high speeds. They were in their element. From the very beginning, Rodriguez loved to fly, and he had ambitions to become a fighter pilot, the most elite and coveted position within the Air Force. But he would never reach such a goal unless he somehow managed to raise himself up to the skill level of the Golden Boys. His problem was that he was quickly overwhelmed by the glut of information that a pilot had to process. The key was to learn how to take a scan pattern of all the instruments, a quick reading here and there, while maintaining a feel for one's overall position in the sky. Losing situational awareness could prove fatal. For him, this scanning ability could only come through endless hours of practice on the simulator and in flying, until it became relatively automatic. Rodriguez had played sports in high school, and he knew the value of practice and repetition. But this was a lot more complex than any sport or any skill he had ever tried to master. As soon as he became comfortable with the instruments, he would be faced with the daunting task of learning to execute various flying maneuvers, like rolls, and to develop a feel for the exact speeds needed to enter them. All of this required extremely rapid mental calculations. The Golden Boys would ace these maneuvers in no time. For Rodriguez, it would require a lot of repetition and intense focus every time he entered the cockpit. He noticed sometimes that his body would get there ahead of his mind. His nerves and his fingers would intuit a sense of what command of the maneuver should feel like. He would then consciously aim to recreate that feeling. Once this mark was passed, he would have to learn how to fly in formation, working with other pilots in an intricately coordinated team. Flying in formation meant juggling several skills at the same time, and the complexity of it all could be mind-boggling. Part of him was motivated by the great excitement he felt commanding such a jet and working with the team, and part of him was also motivated by the challenge. He had noticed that in gaining control of the jet and the various maneuvers, he had developed acute powers of concentration. He could tune everything out and immerse himself completely in the moment. This made every new skill set a little easier to master. Slowly, through sheer tenacity and practice, he rose to the top of his class and was considered among the few who could serve as fighter pilots. But there remained one last hurdle in his ascent to the top, flying in the high-scale exercises run by all branches of the military. In this case, it was a matter of understanding the overall mission and operating in an intricately orchestrated land-air-sea campaign. It required an even higher level of awareness, and at moments during these exercises, Rodriguez had an odd sensation. He was no longer focusing on the various physical elements of flying or on the individual skill components, but was thinking and feeling the overall campaign and how he fit into it in a seamless fashion. It was a sensation of mastery, and it was fleeting. He also noticed a slight gap between himself and the Golden Boys. They had relied for so long on their natural skills that they had not cultivated the same level of concentration that he now possessed. In many ways, he had surpassed them. After participating in a few of these exercises, Rodriguez had risen to elite status. On January 19, 1991, in the space of a few minutes, all of his elaborate training and practice would be put to the ultimate test. A few days before, the United States and Allied forces had launched Operation Desert Storm in response to Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait. The morning of the 19th, Rodriguez and his wingman, Craig Mole Underhill, flew into Iraq as part of a 36-aircraft strike force, heading toward a target near Baghdad. It was his first real taste of combat. Flying F-15s, he and Mole quickly spotted a pair of Iraqi MiG fighters in the distance and decided to give chase. Within seconds, they realized that they had been lured into a trap, the pursuer turning into the pursued, as two MiGs now bore down on them from an unexpected direction. Realizing how quickly one of the enemy planes was approaching, Rodriguez suddenly jettisoned his fuel tanks for greater speed and maneuverability. He then dove toward the ground, below the level of the approaching MiG, doing everything he could to make it difficult for the enemy to get a read on him with his radar, including flying at a right angle to the ground to make his plane as skinny as possible. Without a radar reading, the MiG could not launch a missile. Everything was happening so fast. At any moment, his own radar could light up, indicating the enemy had locked into him and he was as good as dead. He had one chance to make it, evading the MiG until it got too close to fire and drawing it into a dogfight, a circular battle in the air that was a rare occurrence in modern warfare. At the back of his mind, he was also trying to buy enough time for his wingman to help him out, and he could somehow sense Mole's presence following him from a distance. But time would bring another danger, the presence of the second MiG on the scene. He tried every evasive maneuver in the book. He saw the MiG getting closer and closer when suddenly he heard from Mole, who had been following him and had now maneuvered into position. As Rodriguez looked over his shoulder, he could see the enemy MiG exploding. Mole's missile had struck it. As the chase had unfolded, everything had gone as Rodriguez wanted, but there was not a second to relax. The second MiG was now rapidly approaching. Mole ascended to 20,000 feet. As the MiG bore down on Rodriguez's plane, its pilot realized Mole's presence above him and began to maneuver up and down to somehow escape being trapped between the two of them. Using this instant of confusion, Rodriguez was able to get inside the MiG's turning circle. It had now turned into a classic two-circle dogfight, in which each plane tried to circle onto the tail of the other and into firing range, moving closer to the ground with each succeeding loop. They circled and circled around each other. Finally, at 3,600 feet, Rodriguez got a reading and locked his missiles on the MiG. The Iraqi pilot went into a hard, evasive maneuver, turning directly toward the ground, flipping upside down, and trying to circle into a reverse direction to escape. But in the few seconds of the dogfight, the pilot had lost awareness of how close they had drifted to the ground, and he crashed into the desert below. Mole and Rodriguez returned to the base to debrief their superiors on the mission. But as Rodriguez went over it all and watched video of the encounters, he had a strange sensation. He could not really recall any moment of it. It had happened so fast. The entire encounter with the MiGs had only lasted 3 to 4 minutes, and the final dogfight a matter of seconds. He must have been thinking in some way. He had executed some nearly perfect maneuvers. For instance, he had no recollection of deciding to jettison the fuel tanks, nor where such an idea came from. It must have been something he had learned, and somehow in the moment it had simply occurred to him, and very easily might have saved his life. The evasive maneuvers he executed with the first MiG astounded his superiors. They were so fast and effective. His awareness during the dogfight must have been exceptionally keen. He had circled to his opponent's tail in ever faster cycles, never losing sight of the desert floor they were approaching. How could he explain all of these maneuvers? He could hardly remember them. All he knew was that in the moment he hadn't been experiencing fear, but rather an intense adrenaline rush that made his body and mind operate in total harmony, with a kind of thinking that moved in milliseconds and was too fast for him to analyze. For 3 days after the encounter, he could not sleep, the adrenaline still coursing through his veins. It made him realize that the body possesses latent physiological powers, unleashed in such dramatic moments, that elevate the mind to an even higher level of focus. Rodriguez would go on to have one more kill in Desert Storm and another in the 1999 Kosovo campaign, more than any pilot in recent combat, earning him the nickname the Last American Ace. In our daily conscious activity, we generally experience a separation between the mind and the body. We think about our bodies and our physical actions. Animals do not experience this division. When we start to learn any skill that has a physical component, this separation becomes even more apparent. We have to think about the various actions involved, the steps we have to follow. We are aware of our slowness and of how our bodies respond in an awkward way. At certain points, as we improve, we have glimpses of how this process could function differently, of how it might feel to practice the skill fluidly, with the mind not getting in the way of the body. With such glimpses, we know what to aim for. If we take our practice far enough, the skill becomes automatic, and we have the sensation that the mind and the body are operating as one. If we are learning a complex skill, such as flying a jet in combat, we must master a series of simple skills, one on top of the other. Each time one skill becomes automatic, the mind is freed up to focus on the higher one. At the very end of this process, when there are no more simple skills to learn, The brain has assimilated an incredible amount of information, all of which has become internalized, part of our nervous system. The whole complex skill is now inside us and at our fingertips. We are thinking, but in a different way, with the body and mind completely fused. We are transformed. We possess a form of intelligence that allows us to approximate the instinctual power of animals, but only through a conscious, deliberate, and extended practice. In our culture, we tend to denigrate practice. We want to imagine that great feats occur naturally, that they are a sign of someone's genius or superior talent. Getting to a high level of achievement through practice seems so banal, so uninspiring. Besides, we don't want to have to think of the 10,000 to 20,000 hours that go into such mastery. These values of ours are oddly counterproductive. They cloak from us the fact that almost anyone can reach such heights through tenacious effort, something that should encourage us all. It is time to reverse this prejudice against conscious effort and to see the powers we gain through practice and discipline as eminently inspiring and even miraculous. The ability to master complicated skills by building connections in the brain is the product of millions of years of evolution and the source of all of our material and cultural powers. When we sense the possible unity of mind and body in the early stages of practice, we are being guided toward this power. It is the natural bent of our brain to want to move in this direction, to elevate its powers through repetition. To lose our connection to this natural inclination is the height of madness and will lead to a world in which no one has the patience to master complex skills. As individuals, we must resist such a trend and venerate the transformative powers we gain through practice. 4. Internalize the details, the life force. As the illegitimate son of the notary Ser Piero da Vinci, Leonardo da Vinci was essentially barred from studying and practicing the traditional professional careers, medicine, law, and so on, and from higher education. And so as a boy growing up in the town of Vinci near Florence, he received little formal education. He spent much of his time roaming around the countryside and venturing into the forests outside his town. He was enchanted by the incredible variety of life he found there, and the dramatic rock formations and waterfalls that were part of the landscape. As his father was a notary, there was a fair amount of paper, a rare commodity at the time, in the family house. And feeling a great desire to draw all that he saw on his walks, he began stealing sheets of paper and carrying them with him. He would sit on a rock and draw the insects, birds, and flowers that fascinated him. He never received any instruction. He simply drew what he saw, and he began to notice that in trying to capture these things on paper, he had to think deeply. He had to focus on the details that the eye would often pass over. In drawing plants, for instance, he began to notice the subtle distinctions in the stamens of various flowers and how they were different from one another. He would notice the transformations these plants went through on their way to blossoming, and he would capture these changes in sequential drawings. In going so deeply into their details, he had fleeting intimations of what animated these plants from within, what made them distinct and alive. Soon, thinking and drawing became fused in his mind. Through drawing things in the world around him, he came to understand them. His progress at drawing was so astounding that his father thought of finding him a position as an apprentice in one of the various studios in Florence. Working in the arts was one of the few professions open to illegitimate sons. In 1466, using his influence as a respected notary in Florence, he managed to secure a position for his 14-year-old son in the workshop of the great artist Verrocchio. For Leonardo, this was a perfect fit. Verrocchio was deeply influenced by the enlightened spirit of the times, and his apprentices were taught to approach their work with the seriousness of scientists. For instance, plaster casts of human figures would be placed about the studio with various pieces of fabric draped over them. The apprentices had to learn to concentrate deeply and recognize the different creases and shadows that would form. They had to learn how to reproduce them realistically. Leonardo loved learning in this way, and soon it became apparent to Verrocchio that his young apprentice had developed an exceptional eye for detail. By 1472, Leonardo was one of Verrocchio's top assistants, helping him on his large-scale paintings and taking on a fair amount of responsibility. In Verrocchio's The Baptism of Christ, Leonardo was given the task of painting one of the two angels off to the side, and this work is now the oldest example we have of his painting. When Verrocchio saw the results of Leonardo's work, he was astounded. The face of the angel had a quality he had never seen before. It seemed to literally glow from within. The look on the angel's face seemed uncannily real and expressive. Although it might have seemed like magic to Verrocchio, recent X-rays have revealed some of the secrets to Leonardo's early technique. The layers of paint he applied were exceptionally thin, his brushstrokes invisible. He had gradually added more layers, each ever so slightly darker than the last. Operating in this way, and experimenting with different pigments, he had taught himself how to capture the delicate contours of human flesh. Because of the thin layers, any light hitting the painting seemed to pass through the angel's face and illuminate it from within. What this revealed was that in the 6 years that he had been working in the studio, he must have applied himself to an elaborate study of the various paints and perfected a style of layering that made everything seem delicate and lifelike, with a feeling of texture and depth. He must have also spent a great deal of time studying the composition of human flesh itself. What this also revealed was the incredible patience of Leonardo, who must have felt a great deal of love for such detailed work. Over the years, after he left Verrocchio's studio and established a name for himself as an artist, Leonardo da Vinci developed a philosophy that would guide his artwork and later his scientific work as well. He noticed that other artists generally started with an overall image they planned to depict, one that would create a startling or spiritual effect. His mind operated differently. He would find himself beginning with a keen focus on details, the various shapes of noses, the possible turnings of the mouth to indicate a mood, the veins in a hand, the intricate knots of trees. These details fascinated him. He had come to believe that by focusing on and understanding such details, he was actually getting closer to the secret of life itself, to the work of the Creator who infused his presence into every living thing and every form of matter. The bones of the hand or the contours of human lips were as inspiring to him as any religious image. For him, painting was a quest to get at the life force that animates all things. In the process of doing so, he believed he could create work that was much more emotional and visceral. And to realize this quest, he invented a series of exercises that he followed with incredible rigor. During the day, he would take endless walks through the city and countryside, his eyes taking in all of the details of the visible world. He would make himself notice something new in every familiar object that he saw. At night, before falling asleep, he would review all of these various objects and details, fixing them in his memory. He was obsessed with capturing the essence of the human face in all of its glorious diversity. For this purpose, he would visit every conceivable place where he could find different types of people: brothels, public houses, prisons, hospitals, prayer corners and churches, country festivals. With his notebook always at hand, he would sketch grimacing, laughing, pained, beatific, leering expressions on an incredible variety of faces. He would follow people in the streets who had a type of face he had never seen before, or some kind of physical deformity, and would sketch them as he walked. He would fill single sheets of paper with dozens of different noses in profile. He seemed particularly interested in lips, finding them just as expressive as eyes. He would repeat all of these exercises at different times of the day, to make sure he could capture the different effects that changing light would have on the human face. For his great painting, The Last Supper, his patron, the Duke of Milan, grew increasingly angry with Leonardo for the time he was taking to finish it. It seemed that all that remained was to fill in the face of Judas, but Leonardo could not find an adequate model. He had taken to visiting the worst parts of Milan to find the most perfectly villainous expression to translate onto Judas, but was having no luck. The Duke accepted his explanation, and soon enough, Leonardo had found the model he wanted. He applied the same rigor to capturing bodies in motion. Part of his philosophy was that life is defined by continual movement and constant change. The artist must be able to render the sensation of dynamic movement in a still image. Ever since he was a young man, he had been obsessed with currents of water and had become quite proficient at capturing the look of waterfalls, cascades, and rushing water. With people, he would spend hours seated on the side of a street, watching pedestrians as they moved by. He would hurriedly sketch the outlines of their figures, capturing their various movements in a stop-action sequence. He had reached the point where he could sketch with incredible rapidity. At home, he would fill in the outlines. To develop his eye for following movement in general, he invented a whole series of different exercises. For instance, one day in his notebook he wrote, "Tomorrow make some silhouettes out of cardboard in various forms and throw them from the top of the terrace through the air. Then draw the movements each makes at different stages of descent." His hunger to get at the core of life by exploring its details drove him into elaborate research on human and animal anatomy. He wanted to be able to draw a human or a cat from the inside out. He personally dissected cadavers, sawing through bones and skulls, and he religiously attended autopsies so that he could see as closely as possible the structure of muscles and nerves. His anatomical drawings were far in advance of anything of his time for their realism and accuracy. To other artists, Leonardo seemed insane for all of this attention to detail. But in the few paintings that he actually completed, the results of such rigorous practice can be seen and felt. More than the work of any other artist of his time, the landscapes in the backgrounds of his paintings seemed infused with life. Every flower, branch, leaf, or stone was rendered in intense detail. But these backgrounds were not simply there to decorate. In an effect known as sfumato, and one that was peculiar to his work, he would soften parts of these backgrounds to the point at which they would melt into the figure in the foreground, giving a dreamlike effect. It was part of his idea that all of life is deeply interconnected and fused on some level. The faces of the women he painted had a pronounced effect on people, and particularly on men, who often fell in love with the female figures he depicted in religious scenes. It wasn't any obvious sensual quality in their expression, but in their ambiguous smiles and their beautifully rendered flesh, the men would recognize a powerfully seductive quality. Leonardo heard many stories of them finding their way to his paintings in various houses and secretly fondling the women in the images and kissing their lips. Much of Leonardo's Mona Lisa has been damaged by attempts to clean and restore it in the past, making it hard to imagine it as it originally appeared, and how its startling qualities shocked the public. Fortunately, we have the critic Vasari's description of it before it became hopelessly altered. "The eyebrows, growing thickly in one place and thinly in another, following the pores of the skin, could not have been more lifelike. The nose, with its ravishingly delicate pink nostrils, was life itself. The shaping of the mouth, where the red of the lips merged with the skin tones of the face, seemed not to be made from colors, but from living flesh. In the hollow of the throat, the observant onlooker could see the pulsing of the veins." Long after Leonardo's death, his paintings continue to have haunting and disturbing effects on viewers. Numerous security guards in museums around the world have been fired for their weird, obsessive relationships to his work. And Leonardo's paintings remained the most vandalized in the history of art. All of this attesting to the power of his work to stir up the most visceral emotions. The primary problem for artists in Leonardo da Vinci's day was the constant pressure to produce more and more work. They had to produce at a relatively high rate in order to keep the commissions coming and remain in the public eye. This influenced the quality of their work. A style had developed in which artists could quickly create effects in their painting that would superficially excite viewers. To create such effects, they would depend on bright colors, unusual juxtapositions and compositions, and dramatic scenes. In the process, they would inevitably gloss over the details in the background and even in the people they portrayed. They did not pay much attention to the flowers or trees or the hands of figures in the foreground. They had to dazzle on the surface. Leonardo recognized this fact early in his career, and it distressed him. It went against his grain in two ways. He hated the feeling of having to hurry with anything, and he loved immersing himself in details for their own sake. He was not interested in creating surface effects. He was animated by a hunger to understand life forms from the inside out, and to grasp the force that makes them dynamic, and to somehow express all of this on a flat surface. And so, not fitting in, he went on his own peculiar path, mixing science and art. To complete his quest, Leonardo had to become what he termed universal. For each object, he had to be able to render all of its details, and he had to extend this knowledge as far as possible to as many objects in the world as he could study. Through sheer accumulation of such details, the essence of life itself became visible to him, and his understanding of this life force became visible in his artwork. In your own work, you must follow the Leonardo path. Most people don't have the patience to absorb their minds in the fine points and minutiae that are intrinsically part of their work. They're in a hurry to create effects and make a splash. They think in large brushstrokes. Their work inevitably reveals their lack of attention to detail. It doesn't connect deeply with the public, and it feels flimsy. If it gets attention, the attention is momentary. You must see whatever you produce as something that has a life and presence of its own. This presence can be vibrant and visceral, or it can be weak and lifeless. A character in a novel, for instance, will come to life for the reader if the writer has put great effort into imagining the details of that character. The writer does not need to literally lay out these details. Readers will feel it in the work and will intuit the level of research that went into the creation of it. All living things are an amalgam of intricate levels of details, animated by the dynamic that connects them. Seeing your work as something alive, your path to mastery is to study and absorb these details in a universal fashion, to the point at which you feel the life force and can express it effortlessly in your work. 5. Widen your vision, the global perspective. Early in his career as a boxing trainer, Freddie Roach felt he knew the business well enough to become highly successful at it. He had fought for years as a professional. He had a boxer's feel for the game. His own trainer had been the legendary Eddie Futch, who had trained Joe Frazier, among others. When Roach's career as a boxer had ended in the mid-1980s, he had served as an apprentice trainer for several years under Futch himself. On his own, Roach had created a novel training technique based on the use of sparring mitts. Wearing these large mitts, he could spar with and teach his fighters in the ring in real time. This added another dimension to his instruction. He worked hard at building a personal rapport with his fighters. And finally, he developed the practice of poring over videos of opposing fighters, studying their styles in depth, and devising an effective counter-strategy based on this study. And yet, despite all of this work, he sensed that something was missing. Everything would go well in practice, but in actual fights, he would often watch from the corner with a helpless feeling as his boxers would go their own way, or would enact only a part of the strategy he had devised. Sometimes he and his fighters would be on the same page, sometimes not. All of this was reflected in the winning percentage of his boxers. Good, but not great. He could remember back to his own days as a fighter under Futch. He had done well in practice, but in actual fights and in the heat of the moment, all strategy and preparation would go out the window and he would try to punch his way to a victory. He had always missed something from Futch's training. Futch had trained him well in all of the separate components of a fight, like offense, defense, and footwork. But Roach never had had a sense of the whole picture or the overall strategy. The connection between himself and Futch had never been that great, and so under pressure in the ring, he would suddenly just revert to his own natural way of fighting. And he now seemed to be having a similar problem with his own fighters. Trying to feel his way through to a process that would bring better results, Roach decided he needed to do for his fighters what had never been done for himself in his own career, namely to give them a feel for the complete picture of the fight. He wanted them to enact the script over all the rounds and to deepen the connection between fighter and trainer. He began by expanding the mitt work, making it not just a component in the training process, but the focal point. Now he would spend hours sparring with his fighters over several rounds. Day after day, feeling their punches and getting a sense of the rhythm of their footwork, he could almost get inside their skin. He could feel their moods, the level of their focus, and the degree to which they were open to instruction. Without ever having to say a word, he could alter their moods and focus by the intensity of the mitt work he did with them. Having trained as a fighter since he was 6 years old, Roach had a feel for every square inch of the ring. With his eyes closed, he could gauge exactly where he stood in the ring at any moment. Training his fighters for hours with the mitt work, he could imprint into them his own sixth sense for the space itself, deliberately maneuvering them into bad positions so they could feel in advance how they were approaching such a dangerous space. In the same way, he would impart to them several ways to avoid such dead positions. One day, as he was studying a video of an opposing fighter, he had an epiphany. His way of watching videos was all wrong. In general, he would focus on a fighter's style, which is something boxers can control and alter for strategic purposes. This suddenly seemed like a superficial way of studying the opponent. A far better strategy would be to look for their habits or tics, the things they couldn't control, no matter how hard they tried. Every fighter has such tics. They are signs of something deeply wired into their rhythms, and they translate into potential weaknesses. Discovering these tics and habits would give Roach a much deeper read on the opponent, cutting to his psyche and to his heart. He began to look for signs of this in the tapes he watched, and in the beginning, it would take him several days to see anything. But in the course of watching so many hours on the opposing fighter, he would get a feel for his ways of moving and thinking. Eventually, he would find the habit he was looking for. For instance, a slight motion of the head that always foreshadowed a particular punch. Now that he had found it, he would see it everywhere on the tapes. After doing this for many different fights over several years, he developed a feel for identifying such tics much more quickly. Based on these discoveries, he would craft a complete strategy that had built-in flexibility. Depending on what the opponent showed in the first round, Roach would have ready several options for his own fighter that would surprise and upset the opponent, keeping him on his heels and in react mode. His strategy would encompass the entire fight. If necessary, his own fighter could sacrifice a round or two without ever losing control of the overall dynamic. Now, in the mitt work, he would go over the strategy endlessly, carefully mimicking the tics and rhythms of the opponent he had come to know so well. He could show his fighters how to mercilessly take advantage of their habits and weaknesses. He would go over the various options to adopt, depending on what the opponent revealed in the first round. By the time the fight itself approached, his fighters would feel as if they had already fought and destroyed this opponent, having faced Roach so many times in preparation. During the progress of the fights themselves, Roach now had a completely different feeling than in the years before. The connection with his fighters was absolute. His vision of the whole picture, the spirit of the opponent, the way to dominate the ring space within each round, the overall strategy to win the fight, was now deeply imprinted into the footwork, punching, and thinking of his own fighter. He could almost feel himself in the ring exchanging punches, but now he had the ultimate satisfaction of controlling both the mind of his own fighter and that of the opponent's. He would watch with mounting excitement as his fighters would slowly wear down their opponents, exploiting their habits and getting inside their heads just as he had taught them to. His winning percentage started to climb to a level that was unprecedented in the sport. His success extended beyond the main fighter in his stable, Manny Pacquiao, to include nearly all of his boxers. Since 2003, he has been named Boxing Trainer of the Year 5 times, no other previous trainer having received the award more than twice. It seems that in modern boxing, he is now in a class all by himself. If we look closely at the career path of Freddie Roach, we can see a transparent example of the development of mastery. His father, a former New England featherweight champion himself, had pushed all of his sons into the sport at a very early age. Freddie Roach himself had begun serious training as a boxer at the age of 6, and this continued all the way to the age of 18, when he turned professional. Those 12 years added up to an extremely deep level of practice and immersion in the sport. For the next 8 years of his life, until he retired from the sport, he fought 53 bouts, an intense fighting schedule. As someone who enjoyed practicing and training, the number of hours he spent in the gym as a professional boxer was much higher than that of other fighters. After retirement, he stayed around the sport, working as an apprentice trainer for Eddie Futch. By the time he began his own career as a trainer, he had accumulated so many overall hours of work in the sport that he already saw boxing from a perspective that was much wider and deeper than that of other trainers. And so, when he felt that there was an even higher level to aim for, this intuition was based on the depth of all those years of practical experience. Inspired by this feeling, he was able to analyze his own work up to that point and see its limitations. Roach knew from his own career that so much of boxing is mental. A fighter who enters the ring with a clear sense of purpose and strategy, and with the confidence that comes from complete preparation, has a much better chance of prevailing. It was one thing to imagine giving his fighter such an advantage, but it was quite another to bring it to pass. Before a fight, there are so many distractions, and during a match, it is so easy to simply react emotionally to the punches and lose any sense of strategy. To overcome these problems, he developed a 2-pronged approach. He crafted a comprehensive and fluid strategy based on his perception of the opponent's habits, and he imprinted this strategy into the nervous system of his fighters through hours of mitt work. On this level, his training did not consist of individual elements that he worked on with his boxers, but of an integrated, seamless form of preparation that closely simulated the experience of a fight, repeated over and over again. It took many years of a hit-and-miss process to create this high-level training, but when it all came together, his success rate skyrocketed. In any competitive environment in which there are winners or losers, the person who has the wider, more global perspective will inevitably prevail. The reason is simple. Such a person will be able to think beyond the moment and control the overall dynamic through careful strategizing. Most people are perpetually locked in the present. Their decisions are overly influenced by the most immediate event. They easily become emotional and ascribe greater significance to a problem than it should have in reality. Moving toward mastery will naturally bring you a more global outlook. But it is always wise to expedite the process by training yourself early on to continually enlarge your perspective. You can do so by always reminding yourself of the overall purpose of the work you are presently engaged in and how this meshes with your long-term goals. In dealing with any problem, you must train yourself to look at how it inevitably connects to a larger picture. If your work is not having the desired effect, you must look at it from all angles until you find the source of the problem. You must not merely observe the rivals in your field, but dissect and uncover their weaknesses. Look wider and think further ahead must be your motto. Through such mental training, you will smooth the path to mastery while separating yourself ever further from the competition.
6. Submit to the other, the inside-out perspective. As narrated in Chapter 2, in December 1977, Daniel Everett, along with his wife Karen and their two children, arrived in a remote village in the Amazonian jungles of Brazil, where they would end up spending a good part of the next 20 years of their lives. The village belonged to a tribe scattered in the area, known as the Pirahá. Everett had been sent there by the Summer Institute of Languages, SIL, a Christian organization that trains future missionaries in the linguistic skills that will enable them to translate the Bible into indigenous languages and help spread the gospel. Everett himself was an ordained minister. The directors at SIL considered Pirahá one of the last frontiers in their quest to translate the Bible into all languages. It represented perhaps the most challenging language for any outsider to learn. The Pirahá had lived for centuries in the same Amazonian basin, resisting all attempts to assimilate or learn Portuguese. Living in such isolation, a point was reached in which no one outside of the Pirahá could speak or understand their language. Several missionaries had been sent there after World War II, and all had failed to make much progress. Despite their training and linguistic talents, they found the language maddeningly elusive. Daniel Everett was one of the most promising linguists the SIL had seen in a long time, and when the Institute presented him with the challenge of the Pirahá, he was more than excited. His wife's parents had been missionaries stationed in Brazil, and Karen had grown up in an environment not too dissimilar to a Pirahá village. It seemed the family was up to the task, and in his first months there, Everett made good progress. He attacked the Pirahá language with great energy. Using the methods he had learned at SIL, he slowly built up a vocabulary and the ability to speak some rudimentary sentences. He copied everything down on index cards and carried them in his belt loop. He was a tireless researcher. Although life in the village presented some challenges for him and his family, he was comfortable with the Pirahá and hoped they had accepted his presence. But soon he began to feel that all was not right. Part of the SIL method was to encourage immersion in the indigenous culture as the best means for learning the language. Missionaries are essentially abandoned to their fate, to sink or swim in the local culture without any crutches to lean on. Perhaps unconsciously, however, Everett could not help but keep some distance and feel ever so slightly superior to the backward culture of the Pirahá. He became aware of this inner distance after several incidents that occurred in the village. First, several months into their stay, his wife and daughter nearly died from malaria. He was rather perturbed by the lack of empathy from the Pirahá about this. A little later, Everett and his wife tried desperately to nurse back to health a Pirahá infant that was gravely ill. The Pirahá were certain the baby would die and seemed bothered by the missionaries' efforts. Then one day, Everett and his wife discovered the baby was dead. The Pirahá had forced alcohol down its throat to kill it. Although he tried to rationalize this event to himself, he could not help but feel some disgust. On another occasion, for apparently no reason, a group of Pirahá men had gotten very drunk and were looking for him in order to kill him. He managed to escape the threat, and nothing else ever happened, but it made him wonder about the safety of his family. More than anything, however, he began to feel disappointed by the Piraha themselves. He had read much about Amazonian tribes, and by any standards, the Piraha did not measure up. They had virtually no material culture, no important tools, artwork, costumes, or jewelry. If women needed a basket, they would find some moist palm leaves, quickly weave them together, use the basket once or twice, and then abandon it. They placed no value on material things, and nothing in their villages was designed to last very long. They had few rituals, and as far as he could tell, no real folklore or creation myths. One time he had been woken up by excitement in the village. Apparently a spirit who lived above the clouds had been sighted and was warning them not to go into the jungle. He looked at what they were looking at and saw nothing. There were no colorful stories being told about this, no relation to any myth, just some villagers excitedly staring off into empty space. They seemed to him like Boy Scouts on a camping trip or a group of hippies, a tribe that had somehow lost its own culture. This disappointment and unease coincided with frustration in his own work. He had made some progress with the language, but it seemed that the more words and phrases he learned, the more questions and puzzles he uncovered. He would think that he had mastered a particular expression, only to find it meant something different or something larger than he had imagined. He could see the children learning the language so easily, but to him, who now lived among them, it seemed beyond his reach. Then one day, he experienced what he would later realize was a turning point. The thatch roof of his family's hut needed replacing, and he decided to enlist some villagers in the effort. Although he felt he had integrated himself into their lives, he had never ventured very far into the surrounding jungles with the Piraha men. Finally, on this occasion, he would go much farther than before to gather the necessary materials. Suddenly, during this trip, he saw an entirely different side to them. While he was stomping and whacking his way through the brush, they seemed to glide through the thick jungle without being touched by a single branch. He was not able to keep up with them, and so he stopped and rested. In the distance, he could hear strange sounds. The Piraha men were clearly speaking to one another, but their words were somehow transposed into whistles. He realized that in the jungle they used this different form of communication, one that would not stand out from the jungle hum. It was a marvelous way to talk without attracting attention, and must have been a great help in hunting. Now he joined them on subsequent forays into the jungle, and his respect for them increased. They could hear and see things he could not perceive at all, dangerous animals, signs of something different or suspicious. Occasionally, it would rain when it was not the rainy season, and in the jungle they had a sixth sense for the weather and knew when a heavy rain was coming, hours before it arrived. They could even predict the arrival of a plane several hours in advance, although he never figured out how. They could identify every plant and its possible medicinal purposes, and knew every square inch of the jungle. If they saw bubbles or ripples in the river, they could instantly tell whether the movement was from a falling rock or from some dangerous animal lurking below the surface. They had a mastery of their environment that he could not sense by seeing them in the village. And as he became aware of this, he began to understand that their life and culture, which at first glance had seemed rather poor according to our standards, was actually something remarkably rich. Over the course of hundreds of years, they had adapted a way of life that was perfectly wedded to the harsh circumstances of their environment. Now, as he looked back on the same incidents that had troubled him before, he could see them in a new light. Living so closely to death on a daily basis, the jungle was teeming with dangers and diseases, they had developed a rather stoic attitude. They could not afford to waste time or energy on mourning rituals or on too much empathy. They could sense when someone was going to die. And being certain that the infant the Everetts had tried to nurse was doomed, they thought it easier and better to hasten its death and not look back. The village men who had thought of killing him had heard that he did not like their drinking. They feared that he was yet another outsider who was going to impose his values and authority on them. They had their reasons for behaving as they did.
but only with time could he see them clearly. He extended his participation in their lives to other aspects, hunting and fishing excursions, gathering roots and vegetables in the fields, and so on. He and his family would share meals with them and interacted with them as much as possible, and in this way, he slowly immersed himself in the Piraha culture. Although it was not immediately apparent, this also initiated a change in his learning of the language itself. It started to come more naturally, less from the tireless work of a field researcher and more from within, from simply living inside their culture. He began to think like a Piraha, to foresee their reactions to what some visiting Westerner would ask of them. He got inside their sense of humor and the kinds of stories they liked to relate around the campfire. And as he began to understand more aspects of their culture and to communicate with a higher degree of proficiency, he noticed more and more peculiarities to the Piraha language. Everett had been indoctrinated in the prevailing beliefs in linguistics championed by Noam Chomsky. According to Chomsky, all languages share certain features, which he designates as universal grammar. This grammar implies a common neurological trait to the brain that allows for the learning of languages among children. According to this theory, we are hardwired for language. But the more time Everett spent among the Piraha, the more signs he saw that their language did not share some of these common features. They had no numbers and no system for counting. They had no specific words for colors, but rather described colors through phrases that related to real objects. According to universal grammar, the most important trait shared by all languages is what is known as recursion, the embedding of phrases within phrases that gives language an almost infinite potential to relate experiences. An example would be, "The food you are eating smells good." Everett could find absolutely no evidence for recursion in Piraha. They would express such ideas in simple assertive phrases, such as, "You are eating food. That food smells good." These exceptions to universal grammar began to pile up as he looked for them. At the same time, the Piraha culture began to make increasing sense to him, which altered his conception of their language. For instance, one time he learned a new word that a Piraha explained to him meant, "What is in your head when you sleep?" The word then means to dream. But the word was used with a special intonation that Piraha use when they are referring to a new experience. Questioning further, he saw that to them, dreaming is simply a different form of experience, not at all a fiction. A dream is as real and immediate to them as anything they encounter in waking life. With more and more of these examples, a theory began to stir in his head, one that he would call the immediate experience principle, IEP. What this means is that for the Piraha, all that concerns them are things that can be experienced in the here and now, or that relate to something that someone personally has experienced in the very recent past. This would account for the peculiarities of their language. Colors and numbers are abstractions that do not fit IEP. Instead of recursion, they have simple declarative statements on what they have seen. His theory would account for their lack of material culture, or of creation myths and stories that refer to something in the past. They had developed this form of culture as the perfect adaptation to their environment and needs. It made them profoundly immersed in the present and remarkably happy. It helped them to psychologically transcend the difficulties of their environment. Because they had no need for anything beyond their immediate experience, they had no words for such things. Everett's theory was the fruit of years and years of deep immersion in their culture. As it came together in his mind, it explained so many things. It could not have been seen or understood in the course of a few months or years, observing them from the outside. The conclusion that he drew from this, one that would provoke much controversy within the field of linguistics, is that culture plays an enormous role in the development of language, and that languages are more different than we have imagined.
Although there are certain common aspects to all human languages, there can be no universal grammar that overrides the relevance of culture. Such a conclusion, he determined, can only come through years of intense fieldwork. Those who make assumptions from far away, based on universal theories, do not see the whole picture. It takes great time and effort to see the differences, to participate in a culture. And because it is so much harder to perceive these differences, culture has not been given its due as one of the primary shaping forces for language and for how we experience the world. The deeper he immersed himself into Pirahã culture, the more it changed him. He not only grew disenchanted with the top-down form of research in linguistics and the ideas it led to, but also with his work as a missionary. These were both attempts to impose on the Pirahã alien ideas and values. He could only imagine that spreading the gospel and converting them to Christianity would completely ruin their culture, which had shaped itself so perfectly to their circumstances and made them so content. With these ideas, he lost his faith in Christianity itself and finally left the church. Learning an alien culture from so deeply inside it, he could no longer accept the superiority of one particular belief or value system. To hold such an opinion, he determined, is merely an illusion that comes from remaining on the outside. For many researchers in circumstances similar to Daniel Everett's, the natural response is to rely on the skills and concepts they have learned for research purposes. This would mean studying the Pirahã as closely as Everett had done in the beginning, taking extensive notes, and trying to make this alien culture fit into the framework already designated by the prevailing theories in linguistics and anthropology. Doing so, such researchers would be rewarded with articles in prestigious journals and solid positions within academia. But in the end, they would remain on the outside, looking in. And a good portion of their conclusions would simply be confirmations of what they had already assumed. The wealth of information that Everett had uncovered about their language and culture would remain unnoticed. Imagine how often this has occurred in the past and still occurs in the present, and how many secrets of indigenous cultures have been lost to us because of this outsider approach. Part of this predilection for the outside perspective originates from a prejudice among scientists. Studying from the outside, many would say, preserves our objectivity. But what kind of objectivity is it when the researcher's perspective is tainted by so many assumptions and pre-digested theories? The reality of the Pirahã could only be seen from within and from participating in their culture. This does not taint the observer with subjectivity. A scientist can participate from within and yet retain his or her reasoning powers. Everett could stand back from their culture and devise his IEP theory. The intuitive and the rational, the inside perspective and science, can easily coexist. For Everett, choosing this inside path required a great deal of courage. It meant physically subjecting himself to the dangers of their life in the jungle. It led to a difficult confrontation with other linguists and all of the problems such conflict presented for his future career as a professor. It led to a profound disenchantment with Christianity, which had meant so much to him as a young man. But he felt compelled to do so by his desire to uncover the reality. And by moving in this unconventional direction, he was able to master an unbelievably complex language system and gain invaluable insights into their culture and the role of culture in general. Understand, we can never really experience what other people are experiencing. We always remain on the outside looking in, and this is the cause of so many misunderstandings and conflicts. But the primal source of human intelligence comes from the development of mirror neurons, which gives us the ability to place ourselves in the skin of another and imagine their experience. Through continual exposure to people and by attempting to think inside them, we can gain an increasing sense of their perspective. But this requires effort on our part.
our natural tendency is to project onto other people our own beliefs and value systems in ways in which we are not even aware. When it comes to studying another culture, it is only through the use of our empathic powers and by participating in their lives that we can begin to overcome these natural projections and arrive at the reality of their experience. To do so, we must overcome our great fear of the other and the unfamiliarity of their ways. We must enter their belief and value systems, their guiding myths, their way of seeing the world. Slowly, the distorted lens through which we first viewed them starts to clear up. Going deeper into their otherness, feeling what they feel, we can discover what makes them different and learn about human nature. This applies to cultures, individuals, and even writers of books. As Nietzsche once wrote, "As soon as you feel yourself against me, you have ceased to understand my position and consequently my arguments. You have to be the victim of the same passion." 7. Synthesize all forms of knowledge. The universal man/woman. Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, 1749-1832, grew up in an unhappy home in Frankfurt, Germany. His father had a failed career in local politics that had left him embittered, and he had become estranged from his young wife. To make up for his own lack of success, Johann's father made certain that his son received the finest education possible. He learned the arts, the sciences, numerous languages, various crafts, fencing, and dancing. But Johann found life in the house under the watchful eye of his father unbearable and stultifying. When he finally left home to study at the university in Leipzig, it was as if he had been set free from prison. All of his pent-up energies, his restlessness, his hunger for women and adventures were suddenly released, and he went wild. He lived the life of a dandy, dressing in the most fashionable clothes and seducing as many young women as he could find. He threw himself into the intellectual life of Leipzig. He could be seen in all of the taverns arguing about this or that philosophy with professors and fellow students. His ideas went against the grain. He ranted against Christianity and yearned for the pagan religion of the ancient Greeks. As one professor noted, it was the well-nigh universal opinion that he had a slate loose in the upper story. And then young Johann fell in love, and any remnant of self-control was finally gone. His letters to friends about this love affair caused them great concern. He swung from elation to deep depression, from adoration to distrust. He stopped eating. He proposed marriage, then broke it off. To many, it looked like he was on the edge of madness. "I'm going downhill faster every day," he wrote to a friend. "3 months will see the end of me." Then suddenly in 1768, in the middle of all this, he collapsed. He awoke to find himself bathed in blood. He had suffered a lung hemorrhage, and for days he was near death. To the doctors, his recovery seemed miraculous. Fearful of a relapse, they made him return to his home in Frankfurt, where he was to be confined to his bed for many months. As he emerged from his illness, young Goethe felt like a different person. He was struck now by two ideas that would remain with him for the rest of his life. First, he had the sensation that he possessed a type of inner spirit that he named his demon. This spirit was an incarnation of all of his intense, restless, demonic energy. It could turn destructive, as it had done in Leipzig, or he could master it and channel it into something productive. This energy was so powerful that it made him swing from one mood or idea to the opposite, from spirituality to sensuality, from naivete to craftiness. This demon, he decided, was a spirit implanted in him at birth, and it encompassed his whole being. How he managed this demon would determine the length of his life and the success of his endeavors. Second, coming so close to death at such an early age made him feel the presence of death in his bones, and this feeling stayed with him for weeks after recovering. As he returned to life, he was suddenly struck by the strangeness of being alive, of possessing a heart and lungs and brain that functioned beyond his conscious control. He felt that there was a life force that transcended the individual incarnations of life, a force not from God — Goethe would remain a pagan his entire life — but from nature itself. In his convalescence, he would take long walks in the country, and his personal sense of the strangeness of life was transferred to the sight of plants and trees and animals. What force brought them to their present, perfectly adapted states of life? What was the source of the energy that made them grow? Feeling as if he had been reprieved from a death sentence, he experienced an insatiable curiosity for this life force. An idea came to him for a story based on the famous German legend of a scholar named Faust, who desperately wants to discover the secret of life, and who meets an incarnation of the devil named Mephistopheles, who helps him in this quest in exchange for possession of his soul. If ever the restless Faust experiences a moment of contentment and wants nothing more from life, then he is to die, and the devil will own his soul. Goethe began to take notes on this drama, and in the dialogues he wrote between the devil and Faust, he could hear his own inner voices, his own demonic dualities talking to each other. Several years later, Goethe began life as a lawyer in Frankfurt. And as before in Leipzig, his demon seemed to take control of him. He hated the conventional life of a lawyer, and he hated all of the conventions that seemed to dominate social life and to disconnect people from nature. He entertained deeply rebellious thoughts, which he channeled into an epistolary novel, The Sorrows of Young Werther. Although the story was loosely based on people he knew and on a young friend who had committed suicide over a failed romance, most of the ideas in it came from his experiences. The novel promoted the superiority of the emotions and advocated a return to a life of sensation and to living closer to nature. It was the precursor of the movement that would come to be known throughout Europe as Romanticism, and it created a powerful reaction in Germany and beyond. Overnight, young Goethe became a celebrity. Almost everyone read the book. Hundreds of young people committed suicide in imitation of the despairing Werther. For Goethe, this success surprised and baffled him. Suddenly, he was hobnobbing with the most famous writers of his time. Slowly, the demon reared its ugly head. He gave himself up to a life of wine, women, and parties. His moods began to swing wildly back and forth. He felt a rising disgust at himself and the world he was frequenting. The circle of writers and intellectuals who dominated his social life annoyed him to no end. They were so smug, and their world was as disconnected from reality and nature as that of lawyers. He felt increasingly constricted by his reputation as a sensational writer. In 1775, a year after the publication of Werther, he received an invitation from the Duke of Weimar to stay in his duchy and serve as a personal advisor and minister. The Duke was a great admirer of his writing and was trying to recruit more artists to his rather dull court. For Goethe, however, this was the opportunity he was waiting for. He could say goodbye to the literary world and bury himself in Weimar. He could pour his energies into political work and into science, taming that damnable inner demon. He accepted the invitation, and except for one later trip to Italy, he would spend the rest of his life in Weimar. In Weimar, Goethe had the idea of trying to modernize the local government, but he quickly realized that the Duke was weak and undisciplined, and that any attempt at reforming the duchy was doomed. There was too much corruption. And so slowly he poured his energies into his new passion in life, the sciences. He focused on geology, botany, and anatomy. His years of writing poetry and novels were over. He began to collect a large amount of stones, plants, and bones that he could study in his house at all hours. And as he looked deeply into these sciences, he began to see strange connections between them. In geology, changes in the earth occur with great slowness, over immensely long periods of time, too slowly to be observed in the span of a single lifetime. Plants are in a continual state of metamorphosis. from the most primitive beginnings of the seed to the flower or tree. All life on the planet is in an ever-present state of development, one life form growing out of another. He began to entertain the radical idea that humans themselves evolved from primitive life forms. That was the way, after all, of nature. One of the main arguments of the time against such evolutionary theory was the non-existence of the intermaxillary bone in humans. It exists in all lower animals in the jaw, including primates, but at the time could not be found in the human skull. This was paraded as evidence that man is separate and created by a divine force. Based on his idea that all of nature is interconnected, Goethe could not accept such a hypothesis, and through much research, he discovered remnants of the intermaxillary bone in the upper cheekbones of human infants, the ultimate indication of our connection to all other life forms. His style of science was unconventional for the time. He had the idea that there existed a form of archetypal plant that could be deduced from the shape and development of all plants. In his study of bones, he liked to compare all life forms to see whether there were similarities in the construction of parts, such as the vertebral column. He was obsessed with the connections between life forms, the result of his Faustian desire to get at the essence of all life. He felt that phenomena in nature contained the theory of their essence in their own structure, if we could only grasp it with our senses and our minds. Almost all scientists at the time ridiculed his work, but in the decades to follow, it was recognized that he had developed perhaps the first real concept of evolution, and his other work was the precursor to such later sciences as morphology and comparative anatomy. In Weimar, Goethe was a changed man, a sober scientist and thinker. But in 1801, another bout of illness came close to killing him yet again. It took years to recover, but by 1805 he felt his strength returning, and with it a return to sensations he had not experienced since his youth. That year initiated one of the strangest and most amazing periods of productivity in the history of the human mind, stretching from his mid-50s to his late 60s. The demon he had repressed for several decades broke loose once more, but now he had the discipline to channel it into all kinds of work. Poems, novels, and plays came pouring out of him. He took up Faust again, writing most of it in this period. His day was an almost insane medley of different studies, writing in the morning, experiments and scientific observations, which were now expanded to chemistry and meteorology in the afternoon, discussions with friends about aesthetics, science, and politics in the evening. He seemed to be tireless and to be going through a second youth. Goethe had now come to the conclusion that all forms of human knowledge are manifestations of the same life force he had intuited in his near-death experience as a young man. The problem with most people, he felt, is that they build artificial walls around subjects and ideas. The real thinker sees the connections, grasps the essence of the life force operating in every individual instance. Why should any individual stop at poetry, or find art unrelated to science, or narrow his or her intellectual interests? The mind was designed to connect things, like a loom that knits together all of the threads of a fabric. If life exists as an organic whole and cannot be separated into parts without losing a sense of the whole, then thinking should make itself equal to the whole. Friends and acquaintances noticed a strange phenomenon in this twilight period of Goethe's life. He loved to talk about the future, decades and centuries ahead. In his Weimar years, he had added to his studies, reading many books on economics, history, and political science. Gaining new insights from these readings, and adding to them his own reasoning, he loved to predict the tide of historical events. And those who witnessed these predictions were later shocked at his prescience. Years before the French Revolution, he had predicted the fall of the Bourbon monarchy, intuiting that it had lost its legitimacy in the eyes of the people. Participating on the German side in battles to overturn the French Revolution, and witnessing the victory of the French civilian army at the Battle of Valmy,
He exclaimed, "Here and now begins a new historical era, and you can all say you have seen it." He meant the coming era of democracies and civilian armies. Now in his 70s, he would tell people that petty nationalism was a dying force, and that one day Europe would form a union like the United States, a development he welcomed. He talked excitedly of the United States itself, predicting that it would someday be the great power in the world, its borders slowly expanding to fill the continent. He discussed his belief that a new science of telegraphy would connect the globe, and that people would have access to the latest news by the hour. He called this future the velocipedic age, one determined by speed. He was concerned that it could lead to a deadening of the human spirit. Finally, at the age of 82, he could sense that the end was near, even though his mind was sparking with more ideas than ever before. He said to a friend that it was a shame that he could not live another 80 years. What new discoveries he could make with all of his accumulated experience. He had been postponing it for years, but now it was time to finally write the ending to Faust itself. The scholar would find a moment of happiness. The devil would take his soul, but divine forces would forgive Faust for his great intellectual ambition, for his relentless quest for knowledge, and would save him from hell. Perhaps Goethe's own judgment on himself. A few months later, he wrote his friend, the great linguist and educator Wilhelm von Humboldt, the following. "The human organs, by means of practice, training, reflection, success or failure, furtherance or resistance, learn to make the necessary connections unconsciously, the acquired and the intuitive working hand in hand, so that a unison results, which is the world's wonder. The world is ruled by bewildered theories of bewildering operations, and nothing is to me more important than, so far as is possible, to turn to the best account what is in me and persists in me, and keep a firm hand upon my idiosyncrasies." These would be the last words he would write. Within a few days he was dead, at the age of 83. For Goethe, a turning point came in his life with the great success of The Sorrows of Young Werther. He could not help but be dazzled by his sudden fame. The people around him were clamoring for an encore. He was only 25 at the time. For the rest of his life, he would deny the public such an encore, and none of his subsequent writings would approach the success of Werther, although in his last years he was recognized as Germany's great genius. To deny the public what it wanted was an act of tremendous courage. To decline to exploit such fame would mean that it would probably never return. He would have to give up all of that attention. But Goethe felt something within him that was much stronger than the lure of fame. He did not want to be imprisoned by this one book, devoting his life to literature and creating a sensation. And so he chose his own unique and strange path in life, guided by an inner force that he called his demon, a spirit of restlessness that impelled him to explore beyond literature, to the core of life itself. All that was necessary was to master and channel this spirit, implanted in him at birth. In the sciences, he followed his unique path, looking for deep patterns in nature. He extended his studies to politics, economics, and history. Returning to literature in the last phase of his life, his head now teemed with links between all forms of knowledge. His poetry, novels, and plays were suffused with science, and his scientific investigations were suffused with poetic intuitions. His insights into history were uncanny. His mastery was not over this subject or that one, but in the connections between them, based on decades of deep observation and thinking. Goethe epitomizes what was known in the Renaissance as the ideal of the universal man, a person so steeped in all forms of knowledge that his mind grows closer to the reality of nature itself and sees secrets that are invisible to most people. Today, some might see a person such as Goethe as a quaint relic of the 18th century, and his ideal of unifying knowledge as a romantic dream. But in fact, the opposite is the case, and for one simple reason. The design of the human brain
its inherent need to make connections and associations, gives it a will of its own. Although this evolution might take various twists and turns in history, the desire to connect will win out in the end, because it is so powerfully a part of our nature and inclination. Aspects of technology now offer unprecedented means to build connections between fields and ideas. The artificial barriers between the arts and the sciences will melt away under the pressure to know and to express our common reality. Our ideas will become closer to nature, more alive and organic. In any way possible, you should strive to be a part of this universalizing process, extending your own knowledge to other branches, further and further out. The rich ideas that will come from such a quest will be their own reward. Reversal. The reversal to mastery is to deny its existence or its importance, and therefore the need to strive for it in any way. But such a reversal can only lead to feelings of powerlessness and disappointment. This reversal leads to enslavement to what we shall call the false self. Your false self is the accumulation of all the voices you have internalized from other people, parents and friends who want you to conform to their ideas of what you should be like and what you should do, as well as societal pressures to adhere to certain values that can easily seduce you. It also includes the voice of your own ego, which constantly tries to protect you from unflattering truths. This self talks to you in clear words, and when it comes to mastery, it says things like, "Mastery is for the geniuses, the exceptionally talented, the freaks of nature. I was simply not born that way." Or it says, "Mastery is ugly and immoral. It is for those who are ambitious and egotistical. Better to accept my lot in life and to work to help other people instead of enriching myself." Or it might say, "Success is all luck. Those we call masters are only people who are at the right place at the right time. I could easily be in their place if I had a lucky break." Or it might also say, "To work for so long at something that requires so much pain and effort, why bother? Better to enjoy my short life and do what I can to get by." As you must know by now, these voices do not speak the truth. Mastery is not a question of genetics or luck, but of following your natural inclinations and the deep desire that stirs you from within. Everyone has such inclinations. This desire within you is not motivated by egotism or sheer ambition for power, both of which are emotions that get in the way of mastery. It is instead a deep expression of something natural, something that marked you at birth as unique. In following your inclinations and moving toward mastery, you make a great contribution to society, enriching it with discoveries and insights, and making the most of the diversity in nature and among human society. It is, in fact, the height of selfishness to merely consume what others create and to retreat into a shell of limited goals and immediate pleasures. Alienating yourself from your inclinations can only lead to pain and disappointment in the long run, and a sense that you have wasted something unique. This pain will be expressed in bitterness and envy, and you will not recognize the true source of your depression. Your true self does not speak in words or banal phrases. Its voice comes from deep within you, from the substrata of your psyche, from something embedded physically within you. It emanates from your uniqueness, and it communicates through sensations and powerful desires that seem to transcend you. You cannot ultimately understand why you are drawn to certain activities or forms of knowledge. This cannot really be verbalized or explained. It is simply a fact of nature. In following this voice, you realize your own potential and satisfy your deepest longings to create and express your uniqueness. It exists for a purpose, and it is your life's task to bring it to fruition. Because we think well of ourselves, but nonetheless never suppose ourselves capable of producing a painting like one of Raphael's or a dramatic scene like one of Shakespeare's, we convince ourselves that the capacity to do so is quite extraordinarily marvelous, a wholly uncommon accident, or, if we are still religiously inclined, a mercy from on high. Thus our vanity, our self-love, promotes the cult of the genius. For only if we think of him as being very remote from us, as a miraculum, does he not aggrieve us. But aside from these suggestions of our vanity, the activity of the genius seems in no way fundamentally different from the activity of the inventor of machines, the scholar of astronomy or history, the master of tactics. All these activities are explicable if one pictures to oneself people whose thinking is active in one direction, who employ everything as material, who always zealously observe their own inner life and that of others, who perceive everywhere models and incentives, who never tire of combining together the means available to them. Genius, too, does nothing but learn first how to lay bricks, then how to build, and continually seek for material and continually form itself around it. Every activity of man is amazingly complicated, not only that of the genius, but none is a miracle. Friedrich Nietzsche. Contemporary Master Biographies. Santiago Calatrava was born in 1951 in Valencia, Spain. He earned his architecture degree from the Polytechnic University of Valencia, and then went on to obtain a Ph.D. in civil engineering from the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, Switzerland. Because of his civil engineering background, Calatrava has focused primarily on large-scale public projects, such as bridges, train stations, museums, cultural centers, and sports complexes. Inspired by organic shapes in nature, Calatrava has sought to infuse these public projects with a mythic yet futuristic quality, featuring parts of buildings that move and change shape. Among his notable designs are BCE Place Galleria in Toronto, Canada, 1992, Oriente Railway Station in Lisbon, Portugal, 1998, the extension to the Milwaukee Art Museum, 2001, the Puente de la Mujer in Buenos Aires, Argentina, 2001, Auditorio de Tenerife in Santa Cruz, the Canary Islands, 2003, the Athens Olympic Sports Complex, 2004, the Turning Torso Tower in Malmo, Sweden, 2005, and the Light Railway Bridge in Jerusalem, Israel, 2008. He is currently designing the transportation hub at the World Trade Center in New York City, expected to open in 2014. Calatrava is also a renowned sculptor whose work has been shown in galleries all around the world. Among his numerous awards, he has received the Gold Medal from the Institution of Structural Engineers, 1992, and the Gold Medal from the American Institute of Architects, 2005. Daniel Everett was born in 1951 in Holtville, California. He received a degree in foreign missions from the Moody Bible Institute of Chicago and became an ordained minister. After studying linguistics at the Summer Institute of Languages, a Christian organization, Everett and his family were sent as missionaries to the Amazon Basin to live with a small group of hunter and gatherers known as the Pirahá, whose language is not related to any other living dialect. After spending many years among the Pirahá, Everett was finally able to crack the code of their seemingly indecipherable language, and in the process made some discoveries about the nature of human language that continue to stir controversy in linguistics. He has also conducted research and published articles on more than a dozen distinct Amazonian languages. Everett has a Ph.D. in linguistics from the State University of Campinas in Brazil. He served as professor of linguistics and anthropology at the University of Pittsburgh, where he was also chairman of the Department of Linguistics. He has also taught at the University of Manchester, England, and Illinois State University. Everett is currently the Dean of Arts and Sciences at Bentley University. He has published two books, the best-selling Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes,
Life and Language in the Amazonian Jungle, 2008, and Language, the Cultural Tool, 2012. His work with the Piraha is the subject of a documentary, The Grammar of Happiness, 2012. Teresita Fernandez was born in 1968 in Miami, Florida. She received a BFA from Florida International University and her MFA from Virginia Commonwealth University. Fernandez is a conceptual artist who is best known for her public sculptures and for her large-scale pieces in unconventional materials. In her work, she likes to explore how psychology impacts our perception of the world around us. For this purpose, she creates immersive environments that challenge our conventional views of art and nature. Her work has been exhibited in prominent museums around the world, including the Museum of Modern Art in New York, the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, and the Corcoran Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. Her large-scale commissions include a recent site-specific work titled Blind Blue Landscape at the renowned Benesse Art Site in Naoshima, Japan. Fernandez has received numerous awards, including a Guggenheim Fellowship, an American Academy in Rome affiliated fellowship, and a National Endowment for the Arts Artists Grant. In 2005, she was awarded a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship, also known as the Genius Grant. In 2011, President Barack Obama appointed Fernandez to serve on the U.S. Commission on Fine Arts. Paul Graham was born in 1964 in Weymouth, England. His family moved to the United States when he was 4, and he was raised in Monroeville, Pennsylvania. Graham obtained a B.A. in philosophy from Cornell University and a Ph.D. in computer science from Harvard University. He studied painting at the Rhode Island School of Design and the Accademia di Belle Arti in Florence, Italy. In 1995, he co-founded ViaWeb, the first application service provider that allowed users to set up their own internet stores. After Yahoo acquired ViaWeb for close to $50 million and renamed it Yahoo Store, Graham went on to write a highly popular series of online essays about programming, tech startups, the history of technology, and art. Inspired by the reaction to a talk he gave at the Harvard Computer Society in 2005, Graham created Y Combinator, an apprenticeship system that provides seed funding, advice, and mentorship to young tech entrepreneurs. It has since become one of the most successful tech incubators in the world. Its portfolio of over 200 companies is currently worth more than $4 billion and includes Dropbox, Reddit, Looped, and Airbnb. He has published 2 books, On Lisp, 1993, about the computer programming language, and Hackers and Painters, 2004. His online essays can be viewed at paulgraham.com. Temple Grandin was born in 1947 in Boston, Massachusetts. At the age of 3, she was diagnosed with autism. Through special mentoring and work with a speech therapist, she slowly mastered the language skills that allowed her to develop intellectually and to attend various schools, including a high school for gifted children, where she excelled in science. Grandin went on to receive a bachelor's degree in psychology from Franklin Pierce College, a master's degree in animal science from Arizona State University, and a doctorate in animal science from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. After graduation, she worked as a designer of livestock handling facilities. Half the cattle in the United States are handled by equipment she has designed. Her work in this area is devoted to making more humane, stress-free environments for animals in slaughterhouses. For this purpose, she has created a series of guidelines for handling cattle and pigs at meat plants that are now used by companies such as McDonald's. Grandin has become a popular lecturer on animal rights and on autism. She has written several best-selling books, including Thinking in Pictures, My Life with Autism, 1996, Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior, 2005, and The Way I See It, A Personal Look at Autism and Asperger's, 2009. In 2010, she was the subject of an HBO biopic about her life, titled Temple Grandin. She is currently a professor of animal science at Colorado State University. Yoki Matsuoka was born in 1972 in Tokyo, Japan. As a promising young tennis player, Matsuoka came to the United States to attend a high-level tennis academy. She ended up staying, completing her high school studies in the States, and then attending the University of California at Berkeley, where she received a B.S. in electrical engineering and computer science. She received her Ph.D. in electrical engineering and artificial intelligence from MIT. While at MIT, she was the chief engineer at Barrett Technology, where she developed a robotic hand that became an industry standard. She has served as a professor of robotics and mechanical engineering at Carnegie Mellon University and professor of computer science and engineering at the University of Washington at Seattle. At the University of Washington, Matsuoka created a new field, which she called neurobotics, and established the university's neurobotics laboratory, where robotic models and virtual environments are used to understand the biomechanics and neuromuscular control of human limbs. In 2007, Matsuoka was awarded a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship, or Genius Grant. She was a co-founder of Google's X division, where she served as head of innovation. Matsuoka is currently the vice president of technology at Nest Labs, a green technology firm that develops energy-efficient consumer products, such as the Nest Learning Thermostat. Vilayanur S. Ramachandran was born in 1951 in Madras, India. He trained as a doctor, then switched fields to study visual psychology at Trinity College at the University of Cambridge in England, where he received his Ph.D. In 1983, he was appointed Assistant Professor of Psychology at the University of California at San Diego, UCSD. He is currently a Distinguished Professor in the Psychology Department and Neurosciences Program at UCSD, and also serves as the Director of the University's Center for Brain and Cognition. He is best known for his work on bizarre neurological syndromes such as phantom limbs, various body identity disorders, Capgras delusion, in which the sufferer believes that family members have been replaced by imposters, and for his theories on mirror neurons and synesthesia. Among his numerous awards, he has been elected to an honorary life membership to the Royal Institution of Great Britain, fellowships from Oxford University and Stanford University, and the annual Ramon Y. Cajal Award from the International Neuropsychiatry Society. In 2011, Time magazine listed him as one of the most influential people in the world. He is the author of the best-selling Phantoms in the Brain, 1998, as well as A Brief Tour of Human Consciousness, From Imposter Poodles to Purple Numbers, 2005, and The Telltale Brain, A Neuroscientist's Quest for What Makes Us Human, 2010. Freddie Roach was born in 1960 in Dedham, Massachusetts. He began training as a boxer at the age of 6. By the time he turned professional in 1978, Roach had fought 150 amateur bouts. Training under the legendary Eddie Futch, as a professional, Roach compiled a record of 41 wins, 17 by knockout, and 13 losses. After retiring as a fighter in 1986, Roach apprenticed as a trainer under Futch, then started his own career several years later, opening in 1995 his Wild Card Boxing Club in Hollywood, California, where he now trains his stable of fighters. As a trainer, Roach has worked with 28 world champion boxers, including Manny Pacquiao, Mike Tyson, Oscar De La Hoya, Amir Khan, Julio Cesar Chavez Jr., James Toney, and Virgil Hill. He is also the coach of UFC welterweight champion Georges St-Pierre and one of the top female boxers in the world, Lucia Riker. In 1990, Roach was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, but has been able to largely control the effects of it through medication and his rigorous training regimen. Among his numerous awards, he has been named Trainer of the Year by the Boxing Writers Association of America an unprecedented 5 times, and was recently inducted into the International Boxing Hall of Fame. Roach is the focus of the current HBO series On Freddie Roach, directed by Peter Berg. Cesar Rodriguez Jr. was born in 1959 in El Paso, Texas. After graduating from the Citadel, the military college of South Carolina, with a degree in business administration, Rodriguez entered the Air Force undergraduate pilot training program. Trained as a command fighter pilot on the F-15, among other jets, he slowly rose through the ranks, becoming major in 1993, lieutenant colonel in 1997, and full colonel in 2002. He compiled over 3,100 fighter flight hours, 350 of which were in combat operations. He distinguished himself in aerial combat, as he is credited with downing 3 enemy aircraft, 2 Iraqi MiG fighters during Operation Desert Storm, 1991, and a Yugoslavian Air Force MiG during the Yugoslav War, 1999. His 3 kills in active duty are the most of any American pilot since the Vietnam War. Rodriguez commanded the 332nd Expeditionary Operations Group during Operation Iraqi Freedom, 2003. Rodriguez retired from the Air Force in 2006. He is a graduate of the U.S. Air Force Air Command and Staff College and the U.S. Naval War College. Among his numerous medals, he has been awarded 3 Distinguished Flying Crosses, the Legion of Merit, and the Bronze Star. He is currently employed by Raytheon as the Director of International Programs and Growth for their Air Warfare Systems product line. This is Fred Sanders. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Mastery by Robert Greene. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced and directed by John McElroy. Mastery is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, Inc. Copyright 2012. All rights reserved. The book, Mastery, is available wherever Viking books are sold.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.